It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'm coming to you today from Fairbanks, where they do things a bit differently. My two guests have explored vast expanses of the continent on snow machines. Maybe you've gone off on an extra long weekend ride. Well, my guests have been all the way across Alaska, all the way across Canada. Some of these trips have been to gather scientific data. Others have been just for fun. Today, we're going to learn about those adventures, and we're also going to learn about how to do it. What kind of sled do you use? How much gas do you take? How do you cross enormous distances in the Arctic on a snow machine? And we're taping today in Fairbanks at the KUAC radio studios. And thanks very much to KUAC for having us here. My guests are Matthew Sturm, who is a professor at UIF, formerly with the
U.S. Army Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory in Fairbanks.
Oh, wow. Just the name alone is very impressive. And Dave Anderson, who is retired wildlife biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, has done a lot of work with subsistence and worked also with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Thanks for being with us, Dave.
You bet. Thanks, Charles.
And the reason why both of these guys are invited is because some of the trips they have done, which kind of boggle the mind. And I first met Matthew when I was working on a book called The Whale and the Supercomputer in 2002. And I believe we met in the village of Akasuk. You were on your way across from Nome to Barrow.
Yeah, we had started in Nome, and we were just about finished with our trip. Uh-huh. We had, I think, one or two more days to go.
And it was, you know, as I remembered, it was like well below zero, but you guys were just out doing your thing and taking your measurements. You're studying the snow along the way and just traveling. And it was almost like it was routine. It wasn't like an adventure. It was like work.
It was work, actually. John Holmgren, who's traveled with us on most of those trips, you know, he calls it hard work. And the traveling actually was the easy part. It's actually stopping every 25 kilometers and then spending 3 to 5 hours making measurements. That's the hard work.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's what's always impressed me about your trips is that we work all day and maybe do 100 miles, and you're doing that, but you're also able to get some work done, and I'm not quite sure how you've been able to do that.
Yeah, I'm not sure everybody on the trip is like that either at times.
Did you just happen to run into them, Charles, on that trip?
No, I had I was looking for some interesting Arctic scientists and scoped around and heard about Matthew and called him up, and he said, yeah, we are kind of interesting. We've got ice in our beards, and headed out there, and it was this amazing trip, about 6 or 7 weeks, all this equipment. There was an office sled, which had equipment inside it and could get telemetry and stuff. And there was also a teacher from North Carolina who had never really been around snow before and who was suddenly dragged across Alaska.
Were you using Siglin sleds at that time?
Yeah, that's how we'd met Roger Siglin, sort of the dean of traveling, you know, long-distance travel. For almost all of us, he was building sleds at the time. He had retired by then. He was building sleds here in Fairbanks.
Yeah, in the early 2000s, he was still doing
that. Yeah, so I think our first sleds we bought from him. Back to the teacher, in her defense, we knew we were bringing someone inexperienced, so we had insisted on a shakedown trip. And April, who's now got three kids and is still teaching in North Carolina, had gone with us, and we'd left from Nome, and we were working in Council, so that's about a 60 or 70-mile trip. And we got caught in the Solomon blowhole in the worst weather I have been in on any trip ever. And the wind was blowing so strong it was caving the windshields in on the snowmobiles. And there were me and John and Glenn and April. And the three males, we were trying to act like there was nothing wrong.
This is okay.
But in fact, it was terrible.
I've tried that before.
And we finally, there's a little kind of a hut halfway out in the blowhole. And we got to get out of this wind. It's literally caving in the windshield. And we stopped there in April. So I got to go to the bathroom. And I mean, anywhere but in the lee of this building was just inhuman. And off she went. And that's when I knew she'd be fine.
She's tough.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, whoa.
Well, that was the thing about, I remember at the end of that expedition, talking to her, 7 weeks in the Arctic, and she had to go back to North Carolina. And what was tough for her was going home. She had loved it that much and fallen in love with the Arctic, which I know you did, Matthew, a long time ago. And your book, Finding the Arctic, really portrays that. which is, tell us about the expedition that inspired your book.
Well, so, and this is where Dave and I...
You both worked on that one.
Yeah, we both worked on that.
I was loosely affiliated with that one. Okay. I was back home in a comfortable, warm office running the website for that.
Well, you went out a couple days.
Yeah, I did.
I can't remember. Oh, I do remember now how. We'd known that Dave and Roger and some and Dick Hatton had been doing some of these long trips, and I'd always wanted to see the Barrenlands, that central part of Canada.
It's a big, huge, empty middle of the continent, sort of.
It is this vast expanse between Great Slave Lake and Hudson Bay. It's part of the Canadian Shield, and there's never been any communities out there. Now the diamond miners are out there, but back when we went across, and maybe on your first trip, it was still pretty untracked.
It's pretty untracked. I mean, basically, no one lived out there because there's not much to eat in the winter. You have to get out of there.
In terms of the indigenous population,
yeah,
there's just nothing there. Yeah,
there's a couple of really interesting things out there. The Thelon River is a bit of a sanctuary of trees in the middle of a huge desert of tundra. But it's just a fascinating place. It's always had a very kind of seductive history. I think that's why these guys traveled. We went across there. So in 2007... we were able to put together a trip that had both scientific and outreach components. And we'd been talking to Dave and Roger, and so we knew a little bit about it, and there were issues of fuel. And because we were doing outreach, we really wanted to have people track and work with our trip as well. So that's where Dave came in. We needed a way to send back dispatches, which now you do on your iPhone, but back then, you had to set up a computer, a generator, and all sorts of things.
You were working in schools, and you passed through villages.
Yeah.
But the whole trip, I mean, we haven't even given the context. You went from Fairbanks, basically from your office, to Hudson Bay on the eastern side of Canada.
Exactly, from our office. That was kind of the coolest thing.
Which is a distance of how many miles?
Fort Wainwright. I think it was 2,500 miles. It was kind of fun because we had a building near our office right in Fort Wainwright, right in down, essentially part of Fairbanks. And you could drop over an embankment and get on the Chena River, and then you were gone. And, you could go the whole way. And I remember you went looking. Onto the Chena was, the first problem was happened in the first 5 minutes.
You made the mistake of putting me in the lead right out of the bat there. And I had to find a way down the steep Chena River bank. And did somebody tip a machine on that?
Yeah,
it's in the book. I thought that was hilarious. There's all this buildup. We're going to do 3,500 miles across the continent. First 5 minutes, you crash.
Well, it got worse. We got 60 miles out of Fairbanks near Chena Hot Springs, and that's the Quest Trail. And so we were following a trail that, is everybody
well-traveled.
In Alaska, well-traveled and everything. Yeah. But unbeknownst to us, they had originally run it right up the bottom of the North Fork of the Chena, and then the overflow had taken it. So here were these lath, orange top lath, about halfway up in ice, but that's looked like where the trail went. So off, five of us went trying to go up this overflow, and it turns out, even with studs, it's hard to drive on ice. So we went careening up the river and got totally screwed up. We had basically five machines and 10 sleds all piled in a pile.
That was approach to Rosebud.
Right, and Groklos, a local attorney who unfortunately knows all of us, was skiing with his dog right then, and he looked down on what looked like a massive train wreck, and he goes, "What are you guys doing down there?" And we said, "Oh, we're headed across Canada.
We're going to Hudson Bay, right?"
Yeah. And then he finally looked at us, and he took pity, and he just said, "Well, the trail's up here."
So Dave, we were talking a little bit about how you got into this, and it sounds like you were one of some of the earlier trips. You talked about crossing the Barrenlands and being the first ones to do it since the 60s. And this name, Roger Siglin, keeps coming up, and it sounds like one of the keys to being able to do this was the invention here in Fairbanks of sleds that would hold up and would be able to be dragged hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles on a trek. Tell us a bit about Roger and those sleds.
All right. Dick Hatton and Roger Siglin, two good Fairbanks friends of mine, starting in about 1990, started thinking spring is wonderful in the interior. Let's use these things called snow machines to get out and see some country that we hadn't ever seen. And so they started making, I believe their first one was in 89 or 90, progressively longer and longer spring trips, and it became an annual deal. And the weak link that they were finding, they'd get a simple machine, but they were using, you know, old Folda sleds, or they would try some new plastic tub design, and they were finding that the hitches weren't right, or they wouldn't carry enough load, or, you know, off the trail in deep snow, that what was commercially available just wasn't working for them.
And but nobody had ever built anything intended to go hundreds and hundreds of miles.
Well, I don't think so. And Roger came up with this idea now of using UHMW plastic to make a low-profile toboggan sled that would carry a load and was lightweight, even empty. And so by a series of trial and error trips, they finally perfected this design. And by the 90s, they had it down. And they were finding that they could carry huge gas loads because the sled only weighed 50 pounds empty, and it would float in deep snow. You could go off trails. You didn't need to follow the village trails. You could go wherever you wanted to go.
And you're gonna have crashes, and it won't break.
Right. They were almost indestructible. And so then, when Roger retired from the Park Service, other people were catching on to this design, and they were stopping by. Hey, could you make me one? And Roger said, well, maybe in my retirement, this is something that I can do. And he started Siglin Sled Works, where he made these things a limited number. I think he was, you know, maybe making 15 or 20 a year. And they caught on. And they, on the first couple trips that I went on with them, we would actually sandwich two sleds together and plan on selling some along the way. And they were, you know, people, we'd arrive in the village and people were initially kind of not sure about looked like a flimsy little thing. But when they heard what we had come through and saw the loads that we were carrying, they said, oh, I'll give it a try. And they really did catch on. He started getting orders from Canada and made a few for Antarctic expeditions and things like that.
Yeah, and you need these sleds because, essentially snow machines were never built for doing across Alaska. They're built for going a little out of town and back. It's kind of like taking a speedboat and driving it from Anchorage to Juneau. You need a huge amount of gas to make the trip, right? And a huge amount of other gear.
It's interesting to the history of these sleds, because so I came through working in the U.S. Antarctic program, and we'd done some fairly long trips out on the ice cap there, and the sled systems that were used there were based on Nansen, the famous explorer.
Mm-hmm.
There was a sled called a Nansen sled, which is a decked sled. People here in Alaska are used to decked sleds, but usually with a stanchion in the back.
Mm-hmm.
These were very, very long decked sleds, no stanchion, but basically on skis.
Mm-hmm.
And they could hold lots of gear, but they couldn't turn very well. The skis would bind. And so the earliest trips we did, we bought very expensive Nansen sleds out of Seattle, and they were reasonable. It's that particular sled, the last of them, we still have in a warehouse somewhere. But they would flip, and they were lashed sleds. They had stanchions, just like, you know.
They were rigid, so they wouldn't bend with the
deck was rigid, and you know, and they had a particular problem of sort of catching a ski and then running out on an angle and then being yanked back. And the komatiks, which are common in the villages, which are easy to build because you can just go get some lumber, these have the same problem. They'll get on a track that's not behind the machine, run out till they're at the end of their hitch and then yank back. And so we were constantly flipping our Nansen sled, which never happens with the Siglin sled, breaking it. We were constantly repairing it. So, you know, and that was the sort of the competition, if you will, for the Siglin sled.
Right. I wish Siglin was here to talk about it. He's now retired and living in Alpine, Texas, and says the only ice he ever wants to see is in the bottom of his gin and tonic.
But,
he was doing these trips with us until he was in his early 70s. So, but I really think it was the development of the perfection of the Siglin sled that made these trips across the Barrens possible, because they're really flexible, very durable. Anything else would have just gotten beaten to death out there. That snow was like concrete. And that was one of the things that really made these remote, long-distance, unsupported trips possible.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we are recording today in Fairbanks, talking about long-range Arctic snow machine treks. Loading your stuff in the back, your tent, your food, your fuel, and then taking off long village-to-village trips. My guest Matthew Sturm has done a number of them across the Brooks Range, across the North Slope, and then even going east from Alaska through Canada, as has Dave Anderson, who's also done a lot of these long trips, and they've both pioneered some of the equipment and some of the routes and some of the things that can be done, and they're still at it. So you may not be planning on crossing the Arctic, but there's quite a bit we can learn about equipment and how to do stuff right. Everybody gets back safely from these trips, or at least so far. Matthew, I mean, what does it take to stage an expedition when you're headed out for a couple of months? You've got to cache fuel out. You've got to get food. I mean, you've got to have an amazing amount of planning, I would think.
Yeah, there's more planning than there is actually traveling in the long run. You first have to look at where you want to go and how far it'll be between where you can get gas. And it's not even a done deal if you say, well, there's a village, because some villages run out of gas, or you'll get into them and they'll say, no, we're not going to sell you 200 gallons of gas because that's a big chunk of what we've got. Mm-hmm. So you first start looking at that basic logistics. Can we get from here to there? Things are changing now. Originally, we were all driving two-stroke machines. They didn't get good gas mileage. They had a really good power, to weight ratio, but they burned gas like crazy, even the smaller machines. So you'd ask yourself, what's our real distance in hauling sleds in deep snow? What can we expect to make? Can we get from here to there, by the gas? Can we get gas when we get there? In some places, and this is Dave and our group went at this differently, to get across the Barrenlands, which are really how far is it?
600 miles?
Lutz LK to Baker Lake, we clocked at 675 miles.
So you got 675 miles.
It's completely uninhabited.
Nothing there.
There's nothing there. You either put a gas cache in, or you leave incredibly heavy and hope you're going to make it. They took the second route. We we had some financing that would help us. We were able to put a gas cache in.
Which
that,
is by helicopter or
it was put in by
a ski plane?
Probably a float plane in the summer. Did you do it in the summer?
No, it was done with a ski plane in the winter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was put in with an otter. Uh-huh. Partly we were working with the Canadian government scientists making measurements across the Barrens because they needed those. So that helped us. Without the gas cache and two-stroke machines, you couldn't do it. Now, I think with four-stroke machines, it just might be possible.
The expeditions you do have been mostly funded through grants because you're doing scientific work on the expedition.
Yeah.
Give us a sort of a ballpark figure of what it costs to do one of these two-month expeditions.
I think to get seven of us across the Barrenlands, all told was $70,000. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that was gas and everything else, not salaries. But if you just looked at the logistics, food, fuel, the machines themselves. I guess we had the machines. So about $70,000. And for that, we were out about 2 months.
Uh-huh.
So it's actually not amazingly expensive when you consider research done on an icebreaker or an ocean-going research vessel.
Spend
it's about
$40,000
a day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds like a lot if you're trying to do it out of your pocket. And it can be done a lot cheaper. Like last year, we were not on a sponsored expedition. We were just out. And I don't think we ever totaled up what we spent. But we spent almost as much sort of at motel rooms and White Horses.
The layovers can kill you.
Camping is cheap. So, Dave, how does your staging and how you do these trips differ from what Matthew's been talking about?
Well, it's still very time-consuming to plan. I remember the big trip we were on in 99, the Baffin Island trip, that was a year in planning. And we were not a research outfit, so we were doing this all out of pocket on our own, kind of on a shoestring. But we bought machines in Yellowknife to start that trip, brand new there. Broke them in on Great Slave Lake for a day or two, and we had shipped in our sleds with all our expedition gear on there, and then took off from there. That trip was 3,400 miles. We did it in 43 days, but we left Great Slave Lake with, as Matthew said, the strategy for us was to, we didn't have gas cash out there. So when we, our last chance to get gas leaving the lake was Lutzil K. And we made sure everything, the machines were full and every 5 gallon. We found out that trip that you could actually fit 5.8 gallons into a 5 gallon yeah, can. Right. And that 0.8 means a lot when you're out in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. And we had a 700 mile range with a full load of fuel, and we had all the food we needed for a month. We had 30 days of frozen dinners in our sleds.
Did you get there just like at the bitter end of all your supplies when you got to the
You know, we went through 10 communities on that trip. About half of those were on Baffin Island. There wasn't much in the Barrens to go through, but we could resupply a little bit in the villages, especially with, you know, just snacky type food.
You jumped off Great Slave at Lutzil K?
At Lutzil, we went up the historic Pikes Portage.
You went Pikes Portage, yeah.
You know, for those that don't know, Great Slave Lake is sort of incised. It's not an easy place to get off of, and it's still heavily treed around there, but right off of the lake, you know, 10 miles off the lake, you're into the Barrens. But there's only one real traditional route up off of a Great Slave, and it's an uphill slog, especially with a full sled.
It might be worth for the listeners to talk a little bit about what constitutes a route. Yeah. You know, in the summer, most people are used to a route being a road or a trail, and pretty much all the traveling we've done, we're still using routes that at least have prehistoric, if not historic.
Sure.
You know, antecedents. And
it's just where nature left a place where you could
travel. There's various ways that you travel. I mean, in Alaska, particularly south of the Brooks Range where we have trees, you pretty much, if someone hasn't cut a trail, you're on a river.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Once you're north of the Brooks Range in Alaska, you're out on the tundra. It's fairly flat. The snow's usually pretty good. And then you can travel just about anywhere. That's not so true in the Barrenlands, where there are a lot of rocks and a moraine and material. So there, and steeper ground than we're used to. So there you once again have to find kind of a route. The most difficult places for us to travel usually are the mountains, where the ground is so steep. There's snow, but it's steep. It's often, there's forest or brush.
And are you planning every day, every mile before you leave home, or is there a bit of improvisation as you're going along and sort of checking it out?
Well, I think for us, you leave with a rough plan and a line on the map that you think you can make. Mm-hmm. And sometimes portions of that have been put down on the map because you've talked to somebody that's been there. Mm-hmm. But then there is usually a reality check that you get to when you're out there actually doing it, and sometimes the reality we can't do that. It doesn't take much if you think about it for a snow machine to not be able to navigate it. A 6 foot straight drop is something you cannot do with pulling a 600 pound sled.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to find a way around that. You know, whether it's a cornice or a little riverbank or whatever. And those little kinds of fine-tuning things don't show up
that could happen all the time. Yeah.
Well, if you remember, you were with us when we started in 2007, and we were going up the over Rosebud. But before we got to Rosebud, we were following the trail pretty well, but it was side-hilled, and there was a lot of seepage, and so steep, you know, sloped over flow ice. And we came across a little creek. I think there were 8 or 9 of us right then, and probably 12 sleds. And we hit that, and we were there for 2 hours. We remember getting everybody up, and it was It was probably a 4 foot step. That's all it was.
It has to do with the snow conditions, the slope of the of what you're trying to go up, and the load you're pulling. You know, it's a, the Barrens were pretty friendly. We found that you could go, you could really go almost anywhere out there, but there are rocks out there, and the wind, the tops of little hills would be wind blown.
Even boulder, even a boulder field or something. Big problem.
Oh yeah.
Well, lots more to talk about in the second half. I want to talk about what it's like camping in the Arctic when it's super cold, what kind of special equipment you use, and some of the other things it takes to prepare, be safe, and keep people comfortable. I mean, you're not out there just to suffer. So we have a lot more to talk about today. I'm in the studio at KUAC in Fairbanks with Matthew Sturm and Dave Anderson, who've done these amazing long-range snow machine expeditions. But now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer Family Calendar. It's a new feature you can look forward to on the first show of every month. Here's Aaron Kirkland of akonthego.com with family activities coming up in December.
Welcome to the Outdoor Explorer Family Calendar. I'm Aaron Kirkland with December's list of family-friendly activities around Alaska, brought to you by akonthego.com. Anchorage Parks and Recreation invites all kids to attend a flashlight candy cane hunt Friday, December 6th at 6 p.m. Santa Claus hid candy canes around Russian Jack Springs Park, and some have special prizes in them. Call 343-4495 for information. $5 per child. Hey, the Alaska Zoo welcomes families to the Christmas Bird Count for Kids on Sunday, December 8th. Meet at 9 a.m. and explore the zoo's outdoor habitats with birding experts. Visit alaskazoo.org for registration information. And this event is $3 per child. Celebrate winter solstice at Eagle River Nature Center's Lantern Walk on Saturday, December 21st at 6 p.m. Bring your own light or borrow one from the center and come prepared to walk snowy trails. This is a free event, but parking is $5 for non-members. Go to ernc.org for more information. Strap on your skis December 22nd and attend the Candy Cane Cross Country Ski Race at Birch Hill in Fairbanks. Kids will ski the course looking for candy canes along the trail, a sweet way to get ready for Christmas. Contact the Fairbanks Nordic Ski Club at nscfairbanks.org for information. The Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward is once again hosting freezing Winter Wednesdays now through February. Alaska residents receive free admission to the center's world-class marine mammal facility, complete with viewing stations. Visit alaskasealife.org for hours and details. Lastly, the Alaska Botanical Garden is offering two classes on Saturday, December 14th. The whole family is invited to attend a guided snowshoe hike through the gardens at noon, and then at 2 p.m., teens and tweens are invited to make ice candles and luminarias, those beautiful displays of fire and ice made from household items. I've got Pat Ryan, Education Director at the Garden, on the phone with us to share a little bit more information. Hello, Pat.
Hi, Aaron. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you. It sounds like there's a busy day coming up at the Garden. Why don't you tell us about each of those events, if you will?
All right. Well, Saturday on the 14th, we do our Ice Candle Luminary Workshop, and actually December 6th, St. Nicholas Day, we've got a luminary kind of walk through the garden. It's first Friday, so we're going to have the garden lit up if people want to come out and see what those candles look like, and then they can come back on the 14th and go ahead and make some. And then that afternoon at noon, we'll be doing a snowshoe walk with Jason Moen from the Forest Service, and Stephen Nickel will join us for another one of those later in the month. And we'll be doing some winter plant and tree ID and talking about our forest health trail here at the garden. And I would suggest bringing a camera. We will have snowshoes available for that event, by the way, so you don't need to bring your own.
Okay, but if people have snowshoes, they can bring their own. But didn't REI donate a couple snowshoes to you guys for use that day?
They did, yeah. They're a very popular rental program, and they're loaning us some for that day. So they are great. We sure thank them.
Fantastic. So if folks are going to attend either one of these events, I'm assuming since they're going to be outside, they need to be prepared. What should people bring, and what do they need to know?
They should be prepared. It is outdoors. We don't have an outdoor facility for the classes, and these obviously would be outdoors. So just bundle up, layer up with the snowshoes. It's not that deep right now. You really don't need gaiters and get to the hole shebang there, but a nice warm boot that you can strap a snowshoe on, and if you have some extra ski poles, it's kind of handy to help keep your balance, and definitely a hat and some decent gloves, and if you've got some kind of snow pant or a rain-type pants, another layer is great. So just layer up, and you'll be great out there. You'll feel better being outside, and you'll get warmed up walking around. It won't be a fast pace, but it'll be a great walk.
Awesome. It sounds fantastic. So how do people register for either one or maybe even both of those glasses events?
You can register at our website at www.alaskabg.org or give us a call at 770-3692.
Fantastic. It sounds like an awesome day. Thanks so much, Pat. And look for links to this event and all those mentioned here on the family calendar at alaskapublic.org. Happy holidays to your outdoor family. I'll be back in January. This is Aaron Kirkland with akonthego.com.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on future programs and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.
And we're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. My name is Charles Wolforth, and we're talking today about long-distance snow machine expeditions. Not something that people have really done for all that long a time, but the idea that you could take a snow machine, start out, say, in Fairbanks and end up in Barrow, or start out in Nome and end up in Kaktovik or something, just take crossing the breadth of Alaska and of Canada with these many-day expeditions by snow machine. And my two guests have done a lot of this and know a lot about it. Matthew Sturm is a professor at University of Alaska Fairbanks. He's a scientist who studies snow, probably knows as much about snow as anybody on Earth, and has done a lot of important work in looking at climate change and how the distribution of snow in Alaska and across the Arctic affects the way the climate is warming. And Dave Anderson, who is a wildlife biologist, has done a lot of work with subsistence and traditional knowledge with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, now retired, and both have done some of these expeditions for work or for just the pleasure and interest of it. Thanks for being with us, both of you. Matthew wrote a really interesting book called Finding the Arctic, which talks about his 2007 trip, which went from Fairbanks to Hudson Bay in the sort of the historic aspects of that journey, the things he found along the way, but a lot of other trips too. And I guess I was curious, as we get started again here, just to each of you to pick a favorite. I mean, what's been like the one that sticks in your mind or the one trip you would never want to have missed? Who wants to go first? Dave?
Yeah, well, it's got to be the Canadian Barren Lands again. That like Matthew said, that's just a real magic place that holds a real spot.
Just purely
in
because
Arctic
of the remoteness?
I think so. Sort of this mystique about it. Uh-huh. But and I've made three trips across there, three different trips. The first one in 99, where we were headed eventually to Iqaluit on Baffin Island. 99 was a critical time in Canadian history. If you remember, that's when Nunavut came into being. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that our trip started in late March in Yellowknife, and we didn't plan it this way, but we crossed the border of the new official Nunavut on April 1, the day it became April 1, which also happened to be my 47th birthday. So that trip stands out in my mind. And then when we got finally to Baker Lake, we realized that April 1 had been declared Nunavut Days, which it still is today, and there were celebrations, a week of celebrations going on in all the villages in Nunavut. So we not only had this magical experience of having made a very memorable winter crossing of the Canadian Barrens, but then we arrived and there were festivities in every village from then on, in Repulse Bay and Iglulik, and it was just, that trip was just outstanding.
Yeah, we've been talking about the remoteness, but the people seem to be a big part of this, the meeting people way out there. And
people you would meet in the villages and also out on the trail. Once you got, within 50 miles of the villages, you'd usually start crossing tracks of hunters and trappers that had been out there. And then you'd run into them and you'd trade stories and they'd be amazed at where you came from and they're looking askance at your gear and asking questions.
What are you driving? Yeah.
And the questions were always about equipment and had you seen any animals? Uh-huh. That's what they wanted to know, is where the caribou were.
Matthew, do you have a favorite?
It would probably be the same, though. Uh-huh. There are some Alaskan trips. And I was sort of thinking, as Dave was talking, most people don't realize that, they know about Lewis and Clark crossing the United States, but I mean, Samuel Hearn made that trip, in 1780s?
Yeah.
The first, and so the history, the remoteness gets you, the stark landscape with its scoured off people, it was under a huge ice sheet until 10,000 years ago, it was scoured off, it's a scoured, tough land, it's very sparse in what's out there, and then this history of people living in what has to be one of the harshest places on earth is absolutely astounding. And then this young guy, he's 23 years old, he's working for the Hudson Bay Company. It's the American Revolution is going on basically to the south. And his boss says, I hear there's copper somewhere back there. Go across this continent. And
he went with native people and it took him almost 2 years.
2 years. Yeah. Just this one lone white guy, and he gets all the way basically to what's Kuglituk, the old town of copper mine. Makes it back, and that's the first the Western world even knows this world exists. So I guess like Dave, it's hard to beat that for just being in somewhere that's completely different than, my normal life. Yeah.
And seeing a part of the world that very few people get to see at that time of year. There's a lot.
Ever, really.
Well, there's a burgeoning summer tourism on the Barrens. The Thelon River itself is very... is attracting a lot of canoeists and kayakers, and you can a lot of ecotourism going out of Yellowknife and there's fishing lodges around there on those big lakes, but wintertime nobody's out.
Yeah,
there.
So let me ask you this: riding a snow machine all day, I haven't done that much of it, but I know that my nerves and my senses feel totally raw. So you get off the snow machine, and now you're like just in the middle of a snowy nothing. It's freezing cold, and you've got to set up a camp of some kind. Walk us through, what the end of the day is like. And I don't know, maybe you guys have different approaches to that.
Probably different. So
same basic. I've traveled with you enough, but there are differences.
Yeah. So we're a little. The very first thing our group does is what we call the rodeo, because you're out there and you've driven in on deep snow. And you have two choices. You can get your snowshoes out and pack stuff down, or you can take these big machines you've been driving and pack a great big sort of area down because you're going to be putting up your tents. So you just drive your machines around, pack a bunch of snow down.
Yep, we do that.
Yeah. So now you've got a packed area. And usually within a day or two of a trip starting, everybody ends up with a job. It's almost unspoken. I'm the lantern guy. My job, I'm good with mantles and lanterns. John is tall. He can reach the top of the tent that I can't.
I remember Glenn Liston is a guy who can tie stuff down
tie
so it doesn't
down.
Fall off.
Yeah. So there's usually somebody who's going to be cooking.
It's funny how you fall into a rhythm. And it takes a couple days on the trail to do that, but then you can almost do it without anybody speaking a word. Once you pick the spot, everybody knows what they're supposed to do.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And the tents go up. And so, we're both using Arctic oven tents.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
So the Arctic oven tents, well, early on, we tried Scott tents. You need a tent. We're talking about tents that don't look like your average backpacker's tent. An average backpacker's tent, some really light nylon with some flexible rod-like things. And if the wind comes up, You can maybe weather it out, but it's pretty tough. And they have a single wall, maybe a rain fly. These are bigger tents. We put cots in them. We often have a wood stove that'll go in at least one, if not all of the tents. And so they go together like most people are used to with a tent, but heavier duty, bigger sort of thing.
Insulated?
They're not really insulated. They have
what they have is the unique feature of the Arctic oven tent is a poly fiber. It's got a liner that sort of drapes off of the nylon cover that catches the big problem of winter camping in a tent is your breath moisture goes up there and you bump the tent with your elbow and you get this snowstorm of frost coming on you. Well, the PolyPro liner in these tents kind of absorbs that. And if you get a little bit of heat in we use wood stoves too, it just gets sucked up and it's dry. So that's how they've solved the moisture problem.
Is this another Fairbanks invention?
Yeah.
Another Fairbanks
it
product?
Is, yeah. Uh-huh. And it's the place that makes these is another one of these places where a lot of information gets traded back and forth. Because uh-huh. Alaska Tent and Tarp is making these for work at the North Pole and Antarctica and all over. So you go there and you find out how other people are arranging the cots and how they do the stoves. And
So you talked about a wood stove. What's that like and where are you getting the wood from?
Well, so there are various versions. There's actually titanium versions. It depends on your budget to some extent. You can get a titanium version that's really light. These are small, about the size of two and a half shoe boxes.
Just a little sheet metal stove.
Yeah, a little sheet metal stove. And we're not really heating. That stove goes out when you go to bed, and that tent hits minus 40 about 15 minutes.
It goes to ambient temperature very quickly.
Very quickly.
What we're doing is about 2 hours of heat in the evening, and everyone's got their gear that they've worn all day that's sweaty or whatever hanging up in the drying rack, and that's enough to pull the moisture out of it, get you in the bag, get you comfortable, and then you just let the tent go to ambient. So if it's 40 below outside, that's what it's going to be when you wake up.
Yeah. And so then, you're able to get out of your heavy gear for a little while.
Can get out of your heavy gear and have a bit of relaxation. What people don't realize is all day there may be six or seven of you, but you're not talking to anybody. You're in your own little envelope on your snowmobile. You might even have headphones on. Though that's not the easiest thing in the world. So you actually haven't talked to anybody for 12 hours some days.
Yeah, it's like, hey, what did you see crossing that creek there?
Yeah, you know, there are brief piss breaks when you go, oh, I guess John's still here. You know, but otherwise, you know, it's a pretty solo day. And then all of a sudden you got that time in the evening to decompress. We generally are traveling with people we like and get to exchange
electronics,
sort of
watch a movie and stuff like that.
Often on our trips, we have to have a computer on the science trips because we're crunching data every night. I've made it sound like we're just traveling, but most evenings when I'm on a science-based trip, I've got at the end of that day, I've got 3 to 4 hours on a computer. Eventually,
that 2002 trip, I think you said you took 30,000 data points or something.
Yeah, we're taking a lot of data, and so there's a lot of computer work, but eventually you're just mind numb. So every few days, you got the computer, you got a generator, we'll throw a DVD in. We've learned things about DVDs. Even a brand new DVD vibrated on a sled for 1,000 miles will be so scratched it won't play. you have to stabilize their motion in the case.
Oh, my
God. Yeah. I mean, things you would never think of.
This is where Matthew's group is a little bit more high-tech than ours. I know he's got generators and propane tanks, and it can fix anything. He's got a tool kit that is the envy of anyone.
And he's got John Holmgren who can fix it or build anything.
You've got welders. You can do it. Uh-huh. Drums of fuel, and double sleds. And we're pulling single sleds. And we had the 99 trip to Baffin was the first one that we even had a GPS on. We had GPS and a sat phone on that one, and we felt like we were really high tech. Uh-huh.
So it sounds like you guys have a different philosophy in terms of the kind of machines you're driving as well.
Well, I don't know if it's a different philosophy. It's just that we have, doing this on a shoestring, we buy fairly inexpensive machines. The other thing is that we are often buying new machines where we start and selling them where we end, and so having a sort of a lower end machine that matches what the local people are using makes the gear a lot easier to sell at the other end. And so we were using Ski-Doo Tundras early on, and they were a fixture across the north.
It's relatively easy to repair if it breaks down.
They're single piston, nothing to go wrong, two cycle machine.
Not much power.
And the stuff that Matthew's driving these days is the new latest. It got all the bells and whistles.
The newest. So a number of our trips were with, we went to the next phase up, which were still, they were Scandic 550s. They still had a fairly
small. But these are still cargo
budget.
Sleds. They're not like super high powered, high
speed.
No,
they're utility machines.
Everything we drive, whether it's those guys or us, his are smaller utility machines, ours are just bigger. Nobody who really wants a fast ride. You know, our machines, yours probably could top out at about 45. Ours can maybe hit 60.
We rarely go over 20 miles an hour.
We average probably 10 to 15 miles an hour would be a day average.
Uh-huh.
You know, that.
With stops.
And without even counting the stops.
Wow.
We rarely have a 100-mile day because we're off trail. You've got a lot of route finding. You've got brakes for putting meals in the muffler cookers, and you're making steady progress, but you got to stop and look at
the GPS.
And
for people who don't know, that's where you wrap something up in foil and put it on the machine and let the machine cook it.
Right. When we leave the tent in the morning, we've had coffee and maybe some granola bars or something to get us down the trail. But the real meat that you're going to have during the day is going to be your bacon, egg, and cheese sandwiches or whatever you can cook while you're underway. You just don't have the luxury of stopping long enough to make another camp and eat.
Right.
So
Matthew, you were talking about the machine you drive, which is a wide track, high power.
So many of the trips, and unlike these guys, for a lot of the trips, we had the same machines for multiple trips. We'd bring them back at the end. And the most recent trip, we've moved to four-stroke machines. These are really high-end machines. I wouldn't call them Cadillacs, but they're like F-250 of the snowmobile world. They'll haul a ton, and they'll go through some pretty deep snow. But one of the things we liked about them, actually different from their machines, is these four-strokes are geared so low that they can actually drive at about a mile or two an hour for breaking trail through the woods. So one thing people don't realize, you know, as Dave was saying, all of a sudden there's no trail here. You're in the woods. You know you where you have to go. So you've got to break a trail. And, I mean, out in the open tundra, you can use momentum in your favor. You can go kind of fast to get up a hill. But if there's trees around, now you have to pick your way. And there are really only two ways. One way is to get out on snowshoes in front, pack a trail, let it sit overnight, and come back. And we've done that. But with these newer machines, we can now kind of creep up there and sort of jockey around in ways we didn't used to, because in the old days with our 550s, I'd have to be going 20 miles an hour to break trail through deep snow. So that's been a real pleasure, because it's a bit terrifying to sort of look up through some trees and say, I think there's a route there. Let me just go for it and see if I can actually not get stuck.
Yeah.
And we haven't really explained...
Let me first tell people that it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking obviously about long-range snow machine expeditions. Matthew Sturm is who you just heard talking. He's a professor at University of Alaska Fairbanks. Dave Anderson is also with me, who has done some of these long trips all across Alaska, all across Canada. And we're actually in Fairbanks today where I don't know anybody in Anchorage who does this kind of stuff. This is like one of those Fairbanks legendary things that
really?
They do. Well, maybe they probably are. I'll probably get some Facebook messages from people, which would be great. Go to Outdoor Explorer and let us know about the trips you've taken and what trips you'd like to take. So, Matthew, you were saying...
Well, I think a little bit of our differences in style came out of the fact that most of my early trips were science-related,
mm-hmm.
and we would have... probably 1,000 pounds of science gear we had to take anyway. So we had to gravitate to these bigger machines because in addition to camping gear and fuel, there were probes for the snow.
Sure,
GPSs,
I remember you
radar.
Had like a unit or a sled that was built with sort of a solid covering on it, and you could go in there and there's a propane heater keeping it 50 degrees.
Yeah, and we needed that because we were literally doing the equivalent of office work on a computer, and we would have to sometimes do that in the field. So in a sense, they really weren't all that different. We had this extra gear, and we would have to haul. You know, and once you get into camp, then it was pretty much the same
thing. So tell us about some of the, I mean, I don't know if you call them adventures or maybe the most brutal or difficult or hairiest things you've been through on one of these trips.
That would probably be, we designed a trip in, following the Baffin Island trip, we did one in 2001 that was an attempt to trace the tree line in North America.
Oh,
so,
God.
Wow.
So the northern limit of trees across Canada sort of makes a diagonal line from the Mackenzie Delta to Hudson Bay. And so we were going to start, the idea was to start at Inuvik. And the idea would be that we would have wood for the stoves at night, and we could run out on the treeless tundra during the day. Well, it was a great plan, but that was foiled very quickly. First of all, you find out that the country kind of has a grain to it, and we were going across that grain.
Right.
Out of Inuvik, all the rivers are running towards the Arctic Ocean, and we were going southeast. And so we were going against the grain, and then we found out something about the tree line. In many places, it is a dramatic, distinct line. One side is barren, the other is a line of spruce. But in most places, there's something called a brush line that nobody talks about.
Yeah.
And it catches snow, and it goes on forever. And so we didn't have this smooth going during the day and into the trees to camp with wood at night. It was a nightmare. And we got caught in deep snow, and we weren't making our 12 miles to the gallon that we expected was cut in half. And we ran out of gas on the Anderson River. I remember we did a calculation. We left Inuvik with enough gas. We thought we could make it to a gas cache, the only trip that we'd ever put a gas cache in, on Artillery Lake. In the Barrens.
Okay, yeah.
And that trip was going to go to Churchill unsupported. We weren't going to go through any communities on that trip. Well, we quickly retreated to the coast because of the conditions of the snow we were in, and we were then headed to Pawlatuck to get more gas. But we did a calculation on the Anderson River about 5 days into the trip and realized that we didn't have enough for four machines to make it. So two of us camped on the Anderson River, and Dick Hatton and I ran back to, ended up, Tuktoyaktuk was the closest place we could get gas. And we made a three-day detour back to get gas so the rest of the group could get to Pawlatuck. So that was probably, and that trip, we never got to Churchill. That one ended, we ended with a mechanical problem in the middle of the Barrens.
Where you want to make sure you're doing your math right, and you don't end up like in the middle of nowhere, right?
Yeah.
So what about you, Matthew? You've been through some horrendous weather.
Yeah. I mean, the weather's bad, but you just have to hole up. I mean, you don't travel through it. We did a trip last year where we tried to trace the Cannell Road. This was a World War II road from the Mackenzie across to Whitehorse, and the roadway itself,
which was abandoned.
It was abandoned within a year of it being built. So the roadway itself has been getting overgrown for 50 years or more. We knew that a few bicyclists had made it through in the summer, and there were some guys from Whitehorse who had made it about 17 years ago, and we thought it was going to be fine, but it was just a brush horror fest.
And you know, and that goes through. There's no chance to resupply that either. That until you get to the Mackenzie Delta.
And unlike some of these other trips, it's known for deep snow, so you're
in tree country,
punching deep snow. And I think we were kind of relying on the fact, you know, in Alaska, you could always bail out and get on a river. But for some reason in the Mackenzie Mountains, the rivers are open, they're wide open, you know, flowing water in the middle of winter. And so, like Dave, we got about 500 miles in, and we were making about 10 miles a day brushing. It was more a brushing trip than anything else.
It was cutting your way through.
Cutting our way through alder and the occasional spruce tree across the road. And
it is miserable.
Yeah, that was pretty miserable. You know, five guys we could have moved faster.
Everybody floundering.
Yeah. All right, so that's the bad. We've got a minute or two left. Now you have to give me the good, that sort of the memory that makes it all worthwhile.
Or
the,
you, there was a day going up the Unaxarac River off of the Latna, up a blind canyon that prehistorically and historically is known to be a route that breaks you through the Brooks Range. Most unlikely looking route from the bottom. Brilliant sunshine, fabulous snow, machines purring. It doesn't get any better than that.
Dave, do you have one?
We made a trip the year we couldn't get through on that tree line trip. We ended up going back the next year, 2002, and started in Churchill and came back the other way. And that, so we made a crossing from Churchill to Great Slave Lake. And I remember on that barren land crossing, we're coming through Esker Country, full moon, 30 below zero, camped in at the base of an esker with a little patch of trees, and we were in a willow patch, and ptarmigan were clucking us to sleep. And I mean, it's nights like those in places like that that keep you coming back.
And I guess just being where nobody's ever been before, but certainly hardly anybody ever goes. I mean, these are places where there's a lot of, for to a large extent, there's no reason for anyone ever to go there. They're just out there. Is that a part of the attractions, or go to a new place?
Part of it, but I think both Dave and I would say just the country's more magical than that. Even if I'd known someone had been there, you get into one of these places, they're not there now, and it's just magical to see it, whether someone's been there or not.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both for being here. I've really enjoyed this. It's really made me want to get out there again and do something really remote. And I guess there's something about Fairbanks that gets that going in people. And it's also really cool, all the great stuff that's been invented here that people are using. And I guess I'm thinking of four inventions we've covered on the show: pack rafts, snow bicycles, these sleds.
Signaling sleds.
And now also the tents. So it's pretty cool. So my guests have been Matthew Sturm, who is a professor at UIF, also author of Finding the Arctic, a really, really good book. You should check it out. Dave Anderson, who's also done a lot of these long trips, a wildlife biologist. And we heard from Aaron Kirkland from akonthego.com doing the Outdoor Explorer Family Calendar. And many thanks to KUAC Fairbanks for welcoming us into their studio for today's show. On next week's show, we're talking about avalanche safety. We'll be talking to experts who predict avalanche conditions and how to teach backcountry travelers to be safe. If you have something you'd like to know about avalanches, check in with us on Facebook at Outdoor Explorer. And thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Kristen Platt. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Outdoor Explorer and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.